banks and international monetary institutions. But anyway, if you've got enough gold and enough dollars, you can do this. You can peg the price. You can peg the price of anything. If you want to peg the price of wheat, for example, if you think that wheat ought to sell for $1.75 a bushel because this is the way it's been ordained, you could do it if you had enough dollars and enough wheat so that you could, through your buying and selling operations, move the price back to $1.75 any time it got above that or below it. Other countries, in turn, peg their currencies either to gold or, more commonly, to the dollar, and thus indirectly to gold. Thus, the country will, Great Britain, for example, will buy and sell pounds and dollars at currently $2.40 for 1 pound. And in this way, all of the currencies of the world have a fixed exchange rate in terms of every other currency. Okay, well now, international transactions, the purpose of this, of course, is so that you know if you want to import something from Great Britain, you've got dollars, the Britishers want pounds, and you know what you're going to have to pay in terms of dollars in order to get what they want to sell and receive pounds. It's a way of, you know, making things neat and order. It's necessary because countries do operate with different currencies, and foreign currency is ordinarily not acceptable in this country, and dollars are ordinarily not acceptable in other countries. But now, international transactions are of many, many types and are conducted by many different individuals, corporations, and governments. But essentially, whenever any, let's say, American, whether corporation, individual, or a government agency, wants to buy, let's say, a bottle of French champagne, either for consumption here or for consumption in Paris, it becomes the same thing, you go over as a tourist and you want to buy a bottle of champagne, what you've got is dollars, and you have to get francs, because the French champagne growers do not want dollars. Which means that your desire for a bottle of French champagne constitutes a supply of dollars and a demand for francs. Well, what's going to happen if the sum total of American demand for French goods exceeds the sum total of French demand for American goods? Well, that's going to mean that there is a greater demand for francs than there is supply of francs. See, when the Frenchmen want to buy something in the U.S., they supply francs in order to buy dollars. When the Americans want to buy something in France, we supply dollars and demand francs. Now, let's see if we can talk in terms of the demand and supply of dollars and demand and supply of francs. Doesn't make a difference. Let's just talk about francs. When Americans all together want to buy more French things than French want to buy American things, the demand for francs exceeds the supply of francs. Well, what will happen? What's going to happen is that we get, first of all, what we call a disequilibrium in the balance of payments. The sum total of American purchases abroad exceeds the sum total of foreign purchases from us. I'm just talking about the U.S. and France to keep it simple. Actually, it's a matter of total world balance. And what's going to happen as a result of this disequilibrium? Well, suppose that $1 is equal to 1/35th of an ounce of gold, and that 1 franc is pegged by the French government as it is at 1/175th of an ounce of gold. That means that $1 buys 5 francs, or a franc is worth 20 cents. But now, if the demand for francs exceeds the supply of francs at this price, you know what happens, the price rises. The price of a franc tends to go up. So that you want to buy francs, instead of paying 20 cents a franc, you're going to wind up paying something like 20 and a half cents a franc. In fact, I think the most current exchange rate is about that. It's about 0.2049. Now, that doesn't seem like very much, you know, but to someone, to a banker who is engaged in extensive transactions, this represents a real opportunity for profit. Because what he can do is take some of the francs that he's got and sell them for gold, ship the gold to the United States, buy dollars with that and make a little profit. Okay? Now this is essentially what happens when countries are on the kind of gold standard that we're now on, and one country experiences a balance of payments deficit. Gold begins to flow from the United States to France. If the United States is trying to buy more abroad than Frenchmen are buying from the United States. This, in short, is what's been happening over the last 10 years. And the result has been fairly spectacular. In 1958, the United States Treasury gold stock stood at $20,534,000,000. In 1967, it stood at $11,982,000,000. So we have lost almost half of our treasury gold stock over a 10-year period. So what? Let me ask you, so what? What are you afraid of? Maybe you haven't thought about it, but I know a lot of people do. A lot of people say, all our gold is going out. That, of course, isn't the end of the story, because at the present time, the total of short-term debts owed to foreigners, reported by banks in the United States, is a little over $30 billion. Now, all of those debts are ultimately a claim on our treasury gold stock. In other words, a French corporation, let's say, is maintaining a checking account in a New York bank. It's got $1 million in that checking account. At any time, they could convert that into francs, and that could constitute a demand upon our gold supply. In other words, we have at the present time about not quite $12 billion worth of treasury gold stock, and we've got about $30 billion worth of claims on that outstanding. So, at any time, it could all go whoosh, and then what? What do you think would happen? Would it worry you? Well, I was talking to a lady a couple of months ago who said that she and her husband wanted to, she's a relatively sophisticated lady. She and her husband wanted to buy a house. Their family is too large for the house they're now in, and they can afford to buy the house. But they had talked it over, and she told me they weren't going to do it now in view of the gold, the uncertainty of the gold situation. And I said, why? And she said, we're just going to have a terrible depression, and I'm afraid Sam is going to lose his job, and we won't be able to keep up the payments on the house. Now, this woman saw some tremendously personal implications and repercussions of all of this, and find a lot of people who feel this way. Many of them aren't as specific in their fears as she is, but they do have the feeling that either we're going to get back into the depression of the 1930s, or we're going to experience a tremendous inflation, or the whole thing's going to blow apart, the dollar's going to disappear, dollars won't be worth anything. Is this the case? Is there a gold crisis?
Well, as long as the American economy can produce the rate it can produce, I don't think a whole lot for us to worry about, for sure.
Okay.
Because we're not on the gold standard internally anyway.
What would happen?
On the world situation, I think it would be more psychological than anything. And too, I don't understand the international monetary system that well, but from what I do understand, I don't think it's that big a crisis there either.
Well, wouldn't you, if you couldn't buy back your dollar at this point? Let's say we get to the point where we've got zero gold, and we cannot. France comes in and has $1 billion worth of American dollars, and they say, "I want gold," and we've got zilch gold in our treasury. What do we do at this point? Do you think the thing that to me that it would look like you could pay it in products and services, which would simply mean you would cut down imports from France and increase exports. But what does this do to the rest of the trade? This affects, this has a this has an effect all the time. This is why we want to cut down, apparently. As I get our balance of payments rather slowly, because you hit this with a market. We suddenly stop all imports. Well, we'll suffer on our exports eventually, not immediately maybe, but in a few months.
Yeah, but notice you're describing, what you're describing is a process where our exports are going to go way up. The French are going to have all these billions of dollars worth of billions of dollars, and they ask for gold, and we say, we ain't got any. And that's it, you know. And so what are they going to do with the gold, with the dollars? There's only one thing left to do, and that's buy American goods, and that constitutes an increase in our exports. It's not really fair to say, yeah, but that increase in our exports will cause a decrease in our exports. That's what you seem to be saying.
No, what I'm saying is that the French are not going to continue to buy our exports if they can convert this in some other way.
What other way is there? If we don't have gold, what can the French do except buy our exports?
They can do nothing except that in the future they're not going to be very interested in having a U.S. dollar, because at this point they're going to be getting much less for this dollar than they had originally invested in. Our exports will be worth less because they are not as desirable there. This dollar is not backed by gold.
Yeah, but as a matter of fact, the French haven't been very interested in holding dollars in recent years anyway.
I'm talking about any country.
Yeah. Okay. All right, let me get into some of these specific things that will happen. Yeah. I wanted to see what some of the vague apprehensions were, and what has come out from John quite correctly is that the world would hardly come to an end. When there was this gold crisis this last spring, you know, the only people on our campus at SMU who weren't particularly worried about it were the economists. And we were receiving invitations from all over the place to come and lecture on the gold crisis. Everyone accepted, I think, two or three of these invitations. You know, people invited us into their classes, and church groups called up, and chamber of commerce, all kinds of people. Give us the scoop, you know, the world is coming to an end, tell us how to avoid the great day of doom. And it was always anticlimactic, because we'd all go in and say, first thing we say is, cool if there ain't no crisis. The crisis was mostly in the headlines and newspapers. So I want to just say, if you don't understand anything else that happened today, let me tell you, don't worry about it. It ain't bad at all. No.
Isn't some of this a little speculation too? Because of the gold crisis, they think that actually we will get more inflation and higher rates of interest, and that they're going in at this point. I mean, this is the average individual's idea. You think they're
maybe
doing a little buying on a margin here?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation. The trouble is, you can't
say
what's cause and what's
effect. I don't say it's accurate, but I say this is.
Let me try to describe what could happen, what would happen. Or I have to say what could happen, because everything depends on everything else. If the United States lost so much gold that we finally had to stop paying the price of gold, the U.S. government had to say, well, we quit. We will no longer pay 1 ounce of gold for every $35 that is presented to us by a legitimate foreign holder. The first thing that would happen is that the dollar would lose its current position as a key reserve currency. You see, at the present time, all nations want some kind of international reserves. Or they want something sort of back in the kitty, so that in case they find at the end of an accounting period that they don't have enough foreign, they haven't earned enough foreign currencies through exports to buy the things that they really need to buy, they can dip into the kitty. It's the same kind of reason that causes you to keep up a savings account, or, you know, some kind of precautionary reserve. Well, now, in what form can a nation hold an international reserve? It has to be something that is acceptable everywhere in the world. Now, gold is, but there isn't enough monetary gold to go around. It's quite obvious that if every country in the world were able to hold that value of reserves which it would like to hold, we could not all hold it in gold. There just isn't that much gold. the dollar has, since the end of World War II, performed the very important function of supplementing the world's international currency reserves. Nations, central banks, and treasuries have been willing to hold dollars in lieu of gold because they felt the dollars were as good as gold. Now, this is what I mean by saying that the dollar has become a key reserve currency. For a while, the pound was something very similar, but for all kinds of reasons, the pound has gradually disappeared, and today not really considered much of a reserve currency at all. This is very important because this has sort of lubricated international exchange since World War II. You see, in the absence of adequate reserves, every country would always be trying to grab a little more of that gold and hoard it off, and it would be taking steps to interfere with trade. It would slap on quotas against imports. It would increase its tariff levels. It would always be trying to keep foreign goods out, because foreign goods represent a currency drain, so that it could build up its gold reserves to the desired level. And this would be very, very damaging to the pattern of international trade. So by having the dollar available as a key reserve currency, we have managed to lubricate the whole system of international trade. Now, this is one relatively important thing that would happen if the United States lost all of its gold and could no longer maintain the dollar at $35 equals 1 ounce of gold. But would anything else happen? Yeah. What else would happen would follow, though, as a consequence of this. And it's impossible to decide what that else might be. Here economists differ, because you really have to look at a crystal ball to decide. One of the things would be the psychological impact. But how important is the psychological impact? You can overcome a psychological impact through education. The gold crisis of this past year had a big impact, largely because the newspapers chose to banner it in headlines. If the newspapers had taken these stories and put them back on the financial page, there would have been far fewer domestic repercussions. You know, there was no way that you could find out by going to the grocery store or by going down to the bank that there was a gold crisis. And the way you could find out was by reading it in the newspaper. And the crisis was sort of a crisis of public understanding. One thing that would certainly happen if the United States had lost its gold and could no longer peg the dollar to gold is that the price of the dollar in terms of foreign currencies would simply be set by supply and demand. Now, that would mean that you couldn't know with the present degree of certainty, if you were an importer or an exporter, what the dollar was worth in terms of other currencies from, say, month to month or year to year. This could be stabilized over short periods of time by operations that the government could still engage in. Canada, for a long time, had a system of free exchange rates, so that the price of the Canadian dollar in terms of other currencies, particularly the US dollar, just fluctuated with the total supply and demand. But the Canadian government kept this from fluctuating radically and rapidly by engaging in stabilizing operations. If the Canadian dollar was tending to depreciate, the Canadian government would intervene to make sure that it depreciated gradually, so as to eliminate speculative gains and losses and sort of smooth out the pattern. And this worked very well. The reason that the Canadian government finally abandoned it was, I think, not economic, but was political. It had to do with, again, psychological factors. Would this be good or bad? There's a great deal of disagreement among economists about this. I belong to that school that feels that it would be good. I am of the anti-gold school, and I feel that the best thing to do with gold would be turn it over to the dentists. What has happened, in my view, in the view of a large number of academic economists, although the practicing economists, that is those who work for central banks, totally disagree. In fact, there's almost a division, a clear-cut division, between those economists who teach in the universities and those economists who work for the Federal Reserve System and the Treasury. The latter are gung-ho gold. You go off gold, they say all kinds of dire repercussions. And the economists working in universities say, we are crucifying mankind upon a cross of gold. And what we are trying to do is maintain the price of gold at an arbitrary and artificial level, and we are putting our economy through a meat chopper in the attempt to do this. And it's just ridiculous. Why should we fix the price of gold? Why not let the price of gold find its own level in the market? We don't fix the price of other things. At least when we do, we know we always get into trouble. After all, gold was selling for $35 an ounce back in 1935. Is there anything else that hasn't gone up in price since 1935? Let's let gold go up in price. So, well, if you happen to think that free markets are relatively efficient devices, you will probably be in favor of letting gold find its own price in the market. And that means cutting out the pegging operations, and that means that the price of the dollar in terms of other currencies is established by supply and demand, which means basically established by the sum total of what people engaging in international transactions want to do. I say this solution, though, is rejected. A lot of people, they want to hang on to gold, and moreover, they want to maintain the price of gold at $35 an ounce. Well, they then have to answer the question, why has the United States been losing gold at this rather rapid rate, and what can we do to stop it? Because clearly we have to stop it if we are going to hang on to the present gold standard. We're going to keep the dollar pegged at $35 an ounce and maintain the dollar as a key reserve currency. Well, basically, of course, it's because the sum total of things that the U.S. wants to do abroad exceeds in value the sum total of things that foreigners want to do in the United States. But why? It isn't because we haven't been able to export as much as we have wanted to import. Because in as far back as most of you could remember, the United States' exports of goods and services has exceeded its imports. But this positive balance has been more than offset in the last 10 years by some other items, principally two. One, of course, is United States government operations abroad. This would include military operations and foreign aid. But in addition, and very important, just as important, is private United States investment abroad. The United States individuals and corporations have been investing at a very substantial rate in foreign countries. And of course, when General Electric wants to invest in England, that is to say, build a plant in England, it has to take dollars and buy pounds, because you can't build a plant in England except by paying for the materials and the labor in pounds. This foreign investment, coupled with the United States government operations abroad, has been sizable. It's tended to run $7-8 billion per year, total of these two things. And that has been a great deal more than enough to offset our $3-4 billion surplus on current account, that is, surplus of our exports over our imports of goods and services. Well, now the question arises, why is this? Why has this been happening? Why don't these things balance up? And there are a number of explanations, and there's probably some truth in all of them, but there's no agreement on which one we ought to focus on, and therefore there's no agreement on what the solution ought to be. Some people say that we're simply trying to live beyond our means, all things considered. The United States, you know, corporations, individuals, and government taken all together, are simply trying to do more than we can do. Let's leave it at that. Well, we're trying to live beyond our means. We're getting into the same sort of difficulties that you would get into if your income were $400 a month and you spent $425 every month. You could do it by borrowing, of course. But what happens if you borrow? Each month you would add $25 to your debts. That's a good analogy. What would your creditors be thinking as each month you added $25 to your debts? They would first be willing, because you'd be paying that interest, and after a while they would wonder if you could ever repay it. And when they finally became convinced that you couldn't repay it, what would they do? Especially if these were all notes payable on demand. Suppose all of your borrowing was in the form of notes payable on demand. So that any time your creditor wanted to, he could call you up and give you 24 hours notice and you had to repay it. That's kind of what the U.S. debts, our liabilities to foreigners are like today. But what would happen in a situation like this? There's some point at which your total indebtedness would build up so high that your creditors would lose confidence in you and they'd begin demanding payment. And of course, as soon as one demands payment, you know, the rest feel, uh-oh, I better get in there quickly, and you would go into bankruptcy. However, the United States wouldn't go into bankruptcy, we just have to go off the gold standard. Another explanation, though, that is given says, no, the United States isn't really trying to do more than she can do. It's just that the dollar is overpriced. The dollar is not really worth as much as the U.S. government says it's worth. Now, actually, this is related to the first thing. Because, you see, if the dollar is overpriced, that creates a kind of an illusion that persuades us that we are capable of doing more things than we're really capable of doing. Do you understand? Blank look. If the dollar exchanges for 5 francs, then ideally, what a dollar buys in the United States, 5 francs ought to buy in France. But if the dollar is overpriced, that means that what a dollar buys in the United States cannot be purchased with 5 francs in France. It takes something more than that. But now, as long as you can get 5 francs, as long as you can get these things, you're just going to go ahead and do it. The exchange rates are out of line, that's what it comes to, and that's creating an illusory situation that ultimately can't. It's got to stop. The situation has to be changed. There's another argument, though, and there's a great deal of disagreement now between these first two positions and those who hold the third position. They simply say, no, it isn't that the dollar is overpriced, it's that gold is underpriced. Now, we've gotten into the habit of thinking of the price of gold is being simply the reciprocal of the price of the dollar. But there's no reason for thinking of it that way. Suppose we just view gold as one commodity among other commodities. Gold, like strawberries, has several uses. You can use gold to fill tea, to make jewelry, to hold in a kitty, to bury in a chest in your apple orchard. It's very, very popular with French farmers. Make plate, family heirlooms, which you salt away, very popular in India. There are many uses for gold. Well, there's a certain amount of gold available. If the demand for gold relative to the supply of gold is dictating a price higher than $35 an ounce, or higher than 175 francs an ounce, it's just stupid to try to hold it down. And all of our problems are caused by this stupidity. You see, one of the reasons now that countries are building up these huge dollar balances, I talked about these $30 billion of U.S. liabilities to foreigners, one reason they're building them up is because they want these reserves, and there's no form in which they can hold them except dollars because there isn't enough gold around. But now there's a magical thing about gold. You could increase the total amount of monetary gold with the stroke of a pen. If the United States government announced tomorrow that gold, an ounce of gold is now worth $70, the world's monetary gold stock would double. And a lot of people say, well, that is what we ought to do. We'll just get rid of the problem like that. It would, too. There's only one catch. The countries that are currently holding these $30 billion of liabilities with full confidence in the United States figure that they could get gold for that at the rate of a 35th of an ounce for every dollar. If we raise the price of gold overnight, they suddenly find the gold value of their assets cut in half. So what? Well, maybe so what very little. If nothing else adjusts, I mean, if everything else remains the same, but only the price of gold goes up, then it really isn't going to make much difference. Because what these foreign holders of dollars want is not ultimately gold. They want the things that gold will buy. What a lot of people fear Well, excuse me, dentists will be affected, yeah.
What about the guys that are holding the gold in relationship to the people that are holding the credit on the gold?
Yeah, well, the people holding the gold will be the tremendous beneficiaries.
How much gold is directed out?
We don't know. We have no idea.
Well, we have some idea, don't we?
No, we do not.
Is that totally secret?
We don't. We just have no way of knowing.
If you double the price of gold, in other words, the guy that's got gold automatically made 100% profit.
Right.
Yeah. That's the psychological impact that you better.
Yeah, this bothers a lot of people. A lot. This is an argument that's used. I think we just have to forget it. That's my view. You would say there are three types of individuals who are definitely going to benefit from this doubling price of gold, and they're all bad guys. There's the Russians. They have a huge amount of gold. We don't know how much, but they're just sitting there hoping we double the price, and then by golly, they're going to clean up. The South Africans, because they're the world's leading producers of gold, this would be a great windfall for them, and you know what bad guys they are. And speculators. See, now all our problem has been caused by these speculators, and you know, the United States government has taken all kinds of steps to prevent American citizens from speculating. And just this past year, we took steps to try to prevent foreigners from speculating. And we got the governments of the world, the major Western governments, all except the French, to agree that they would clamp down on speculators, and they would not sell gold to private holders. And now all of a sudden, you know, after trying to keep these blasted speculators from fouling up the whole international monetary system, we come along and reward them. So three kinds of bad guys: communists, racists, and profiteers are the people who will benefit. And you know, this kind of argument for some people seems to be very persuasive. It is not persuasive for me, because I think that a stable international monetary system is just much more important than keeping communists, racists, and profiteers from making a little money.
But the other part of it is that the people who have held the dollar, who have been so-called friends of ours, will lose.
Well, what will they lose? See, that's the question.
Well, if they want to buy a Cadillac, it will cost them twice as many dollars.
No, not necessarily. That's the thing. If everything else remains the same,
It could.
And probably would remain basically the same. In other words, if the United States moved the price of gold to $70 an ounce, I think you could bank on it that other countries would move the price of their currencies proportionately in terms of gold. Many of them would move automatically because they are tied not to gold but to the dollar. And that means that, let's say a Cadillac costs,
about 5,000.
Well, let's suppose you want a $3,500 car. A Frenchman is thinking of buying a $3,500 car. He's got $3,500. He knows that no matter what happens to the dollar and the franc, he can take his $3,500 and go get him 100 ounces of gold, and it would complicate the procedure. He can get his car for the $3,500 that he saved up. Now, all of a sudden, bingo, the United States increases the price of gold to $70 an ounce. Now his $3,500 will only buy half as much gold. So it seems like he's sustained a loss, right? But as a matter of fact, he would probably still be able now to convert, because the franc would move too. He would still be able to, whether he was holding francs or dollars, wouldn't make any difference, he could convert these things at the same ratios as before, the francs and the dollars, and he would still find that an automobile cost him as much in terms of either dollars or francs as he previously had to pay. So unless he is getting involved in gold, it probably wouldn't make any difference to him.
He'd have the paper loss, and he'd say, well, if I had bought gold as I should have, then I'd have.
That's right, sure. He would say, if I'd been a speculator like the rest of them, right. Well, that's another question. We can let me return to that. That's an important question. I want to mention the fourth thing that people say is wrong. What's causing all of this? And then I'll return to that question. Some people say that the basic problem is inflation in the United States, and so you know there's a lot of demand for keeping down prices. This is a rather funny argument, because The United States would have experienced this kind of chronic balance of payments deficit due to inflation only if the rate of inflation in this country had exceeded the rate of inflation in most of our, and that of most of the rate of inflation in those countries with which we trade. But that has not been the case. Actually, our price level, though it has tended to rise since 1964, has risen rather spectacularly, has been more stable. We have experienced less inflation than most of the countries with which we trade. However, it's even more complicated than that, because when you look simply at the export and import industries, this does not seem to be the case. That is to say, the prices that have gone up most rapidly in this country have tended to be prices in our export and import industries, so that we, in fact, are becoming less competitive in world trade. Now, why is this? That's a long and complicated story. There are many possible explanations. One of them seems to be that the industries in the United States which do a lot of exporting tend to be relatively less competitive. And consequently, they have monopoly power, and they use it, and they boost their prices up. So that the prices in monopolistic industries tend to rise more rapidly than the prices in competitive industries, and our export industries tend to be more monopolistic, and as a result, though our total price level has not increased as rapidly as the price level in other countries, the relevant prices seem to have increased more rapidly, or may have increased more rapidly. Well, what conclusions do you draw from all this? No, you can draw all kinds. You can draw the one, let's get rid of the gold standard. Down the drain, this is giving us a lot of trouble. You can say, let's get the government out of foreign aid. That's a conclusion many people draw. They point to the figures and say, if the United States government weren't trying to do all these things for the world, we wouldn't be having this balance of payments problem. And look at what happens to, we try to help all these countries in the world, what do? They get our dollars and they turn right around and demand our gold. Such ingratitude. The government, meanwhile, has been doing other kinds of things. The government has been telling servicemen they couldn't take their wives abroad. It's been clamping all kinds of restrictions on tourists. It has been penalizing foreign investors. It's been using a combination of moral suasion, special taxes, arm twisting, threats to prevent corporations from investing so much abroad. In other words, the government has been trying to make private citizens bear the burden, while the private citizens are running around yelling, the government should bear the burden. What we have been doing is saying we're going to preserve the present system, including the present price of gold, in order to maintain the present world trading system, even if we have to destroy the present world trading system in order to preserve the price of gold. That's about the way it comes out. And as we say, this whole system of free trade since the war is developed on the basis of the dollar as a key reserve currency and 1 ounce of gold equals $35, and we don't want to throw all of this away, all of this marvelous free trade and exchange convertibility and all of that. So by golly, we will eliminate exchange convertibility and eliminate free trade if necessary in order to hang on to the system that has made it possible, which is a rather funny counsel. Well, now, you asked the question, what about our price, domestic price level? This is a legitimate fear. The people who want to hang on to gold and keep the price of gold at its present level seem to be motivated primarily by fears of inflation. They argue that gold does a couple of things, the most important of which is it imposes an external restraint on government. That the United States government, like all governments, has a tendency to live beyond its means, to spend more than it collects in taxes. Now, this is inflationary. If you don't see why, I think you do see why. But it is. It's very definitely inflationary. Well, what's to prevent a government from doing this? You know, politically it's popular. It's always unpopular to raise taxes, but it's very popular to increase expenditures. So governments, it's true, all democratic governments of the West, they chronically run budget deficits. What restrains them? What keeps them from, for political reasons, causing continual mounting inflation? One thing is the balance of payments. Because they know if they let inflation get too far out of hand, they will experience balance of payments difficulties, and then they will have to clamp on the brakes. Now, if you look at American economic policy in the last 5 or 10 years, you find a lot of support for this thesis. Because the argument that, that say, we have to raise taxes, or cut government expenditures, or tighten up, raise interest rates, in order to prevent inflation has not been popular in America. There are many opponents of this view. People will say you're sacrificing the working man or the veteran or who knows all what for the sake of the few fat cats who are worried about inflation. It seems that you cannot get a majority of people in this country to support tight fiscal and monetary policy for any reason so insubstantial as that it would prevent inflation. It may be because we don't basically believe that inflation is caused by fiscal and monetary policy. We think that inflation is caused by money-grubbing profiteers. That's quite wrong. The basic cause of inflation is always government fiscal and monetary policy. But we don't think of it that way. Or maybe we think that inflation is some kind of an act of God. But in any event, the government seemingly cannot get a consensus to support tight fiscal and monetary policy for any reason like stopping domestic inflation. However, it can get people to agree to a tight fiscal and monetary policy because we've got a serious deficit in the balance of payments. I find that rather odd. It's as if the whole thing is based on an illusion. I think it is. If you say you were kind of above the whole scene, and you look down at it, you describe it this way. Say you were a benevolent despot, but you had to work through, if you're a despot, you could do whatever you wanted. Suppose you were the President of the United States. You look down and you say, look, I'm responsible for the welfare of this country. I've got to prevent inflation. That requires a tight fiscal and monetary policy. But I can't persuade the people and I can't persuade Congress that a tight fiscal and monetary policy would stop inflation. So what I'll do is point out to them that a tight fiscal and monetary policy will eliminate the deficit in the balance of payments. Now you've got another problem. You've got to persuade them now that a deficit in the balance of payments is a bad, bad thing. How can you do that? Well, you tell them that if we keep up this deficit in the balance of payments, we'll lose all our gold. Now you've got to persuade them that losing all our gold is a bad thing. So what do? You invent a parade of imaginary horribles, and you prey upon general public ignorance and our sort of gold fetishism. The fear of my neighbor across the street that if the gold leaves the country, Sam will lose his job. And so you get the policy that the country really needs by exploiting ignorance. To come back to your question, if then we went off the gold standard or jacked the price of gold up so high that it no longer operated as a current restraint, we might well find ourselves experiencing greater inflationary pressure. But my point is, there's no economic necessity for this. It would be due to ignorance, due to the fact that we are somehow unwilling to take those steps which are necessary to preserve a stable price level without this bogeyman of the trouble in the international monetary system to goad it.
This is apparently true not only for the layman we as citizens, but even for our administration, our executive, who did not want to accept the $6 billion cut in the budget, but finally horse traders, and he would. But now would that again that if he wants that our government knows that a tight policy would be better for us,
Remember, a tight fiscal and monetary policy is better for say, most of the people, but it's probably bad for a politician, especially in an election year.
Well, I'm not as pessimistic as far as educating the people, because we have such a large group of people now that are on a relatively fixed income. We have all these Social Security people people that are living on savings. I don't know how much they're percentage. It isn't enough to get the vote, but these are the people whom inflation hurts. And if you can show that inflation will decrease their buying power, that the local bread and the groceries they buy instead of costing $60 a month will now cost $75, I don't see why you couldn't sell this over a period of time if you concentrate enough.
Well, I would hope you could sell it. And I think what you just said can be sold, but that isn't the end of the problem. You've still got a selling problem. You have to persuade people that I think most people are convinced that inflation is a bad thing right now. Some of them aren't convinced that it's as bad a thing as certain other bad things. The real educational task is persuading people that increases in taxes and higher interest rates are ways of preventing inflation. And this proves to be almost impossible. Even those people who will accept it in principle tend to say, but not now, but not these interest rates, not my taxes. That's the dilemma.
Wilbur Mills has gotten a lot of heat on this and has been accused of many things, especially by the administration. Don't you think this is an act of political courage that he's been fighting this thing? Or do you think this is an act of politics on his part? Or just what is your opinion of this from the standpoint of an economist?
I don't know. Wilbur Mills, I have respect for Wilbur Mills. And
he knows.
He's a very knowledgeable man, and I think he's a courageous and public-spirited man. Sometimes he does things I don't understand. I'm sure he'll opportunity to sit down and talk with him.
Well, I just wanted your opinion of the House Ways and Means Committee's stand on this, which they have really been, well, you've really got to hand it to them. They've been really gutsy on this.
Yeah, I'd go along with
them. Yeah, I think they're really, this is the only thing to do, and I'm really upset. I mean, from the standpoint of the administration, trying to pass the buck, you know, it just wouldn't take this. It's been very bad news, I think.
No, it is the task of the executive to initiate spending cuts.
But has it really been for the good of the country to remind him one man standing up for, 18 months or something? But meanwhile, what's happened to our economy and our price structure and our interest rates so on?
Well, maybe he has, but on the other hand, if he had surrendered very early, would there have been any expenditure cut at all?
And
the trouble is that if the government increases taxes by, let's say, $5 billion a year, and simultaneously allows expenditures to drift up by $5 billion a year, this does not neatly cancel out. This has a net inflationary impact for reasons that aren't obvious at all. Can be made clear in little time. So that, and this is what has tended to happen. I'm afraid this is what happens in any modern democracy, that governments spend slightly more than they take in taxes. It's almost a law, like Parkinson's law. They
no
will do it.
Can do it.
Huh?
I say none of us as individuals can do that.
But governments can. Well, but governments can. Well, you say that to say that they shouldn't is one thing. To say that they can is. They have been. They have been. And there are reasons for it that are pretty obvious. All of the pressures that are generated in a democracy to keep taxes low and to spend a little more here and a little more there. Many legitimate programs. So for Wilbur Mills to say, by golly, no. Maybe he's causing troubles. Maybe he's feeding the inflation. On the other hand, maybe the inflation would have gone ahead just as rapidly if Wilbur Mills had conceded right at the beginning, and there never would have been this necessary process of education which Wilbur Mills has been trying to enforce upon people, both the public and the executive branch of the government. I think when you come down to the principle, Wilbur Mills is completely right. The responsibility for initiating, for setting forth the budget and initiating cuts belongs to the executive. He's always assumed that responsibility. When the time comes to say what we're going to spend money for, the executive is willing to say. But when the executive is supposed to say, you know, the executive says, fellas, we've got to cut back, how come he turns this responsibility over to Congress? It's not Congress's job, because the congressman represents particular constituencies. And Wilbur Mills, by golly, it's his job to make sure that the Arkansas River Project is one of the things that is not cut. It's the executive's task, because he's the only one in a position to see the needs of the total country and to balance off one thing against another.
Well, I was just talking about the government officials in Scandinavia have had to cut back. There are socialistic programs. They've had to back up a little bit in some of them, and they're, excuse the fly. But this has happened in Norway. Had a more conservative government.
Let him be at men's wife.
Good setup.
Never was good at volleyball. But and I think that